Hi, everyone. I know you've been hearing me talk about how much I enjoy BritBox. It's the streaming home of the best British TV, with exclusive mysteries, crime dramas, documentaries, and more. I especially enjoy mysteries like Agatha Christie's Poirot and Father Brown. I just enjoyed his story, The Thief, His Wife, and the Canoe. Great story. My daughter has always been a huge Cary Grant fan, and BritBox has a new original called Archie, which stars Jason Isaacs as Archie Leach, the man who became Cary Grant. This is the first time that his story has been told in collaboration with Grant's daughter Jennifer Grant and his ex-wife Diane Cannon. Story and cast all from BritBox, and it's top-notch entertainment, and only on BritBox. Sign up for BritBox today to stream Archie and other fan favorites from any device. I have a special limited-time offer for my U.S. and Canadian fans. Get 50% off your first month when you sign up for a monthly plan, but only if you go to BritBox.com and use my promo code 1001STORIES at checkout. That's 1001STORIES at checkout. Don't wait. Get 50% off your first month. Use promo code 1001STORIES at BritBox.com. You'll be glad you did.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.
Welcome, everyone, to the new 1001 Sherlock Holmes Stories podcast. Here you'll find a collection of Sherlock Holmes adventures, as well as the best of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's stories. Some from our archives at 1001 Classic Short Stories and 1001 Stories for the Road, and some newly produced, all here for your entertainment. Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Sherlock Holmes Stories and the best of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Today, the conclusion of The Valley of Fear, Chapters 6, 7, and Epilogue. And now part Chapter 6, Danger. It was the height of the Reign of Terror. McMurdo, who had already been appointed inner deacon, with every prospect of someday succeeding McGinty as bodymaster, was now so necessary to the councils of his comrades that nothing was done without his help and advice. The more popular he became, however, with the freemen, the blacker were the scowls which greeted him as he passed along the streets of Vermissa. In spite of their terror, the citizens were taking heart to band themselves together against their oppressors. Rumors had reached the lodge of secret gatherings in the Herald office and of distribution of firearms among the law-abiding people. But McGinty and his men were undisturbed by such reports. They were numerous, resolute, and well-armed. Their opponents were scattered and powerless. It would all end, as it had done in the past, in aimless talk and possibly in impotent arrests. So said McGinty, McMurdo, and all the bolder spirits. It was a Saturday evening in May. Saturday was always the lodge night, and McMurdo was leaving his house to attend it when Morris, the weaker brother of the order, came to see him. His brow was creased with care, and his kindly face was drawn and haggard. "Can I speak with you freely, Mr. McMurdo?" "Sure." "I can't forget that I spoke my heart to you once, and that you kept it to yourself, even though the boss himself came to ask you about it." "What else could I do if you trusted me? It wasn't that I agreed with what you said." "I know that well, but you are the one I can speak to and be safe. I have a secret here," he put his hand to his breast, "and it is just burning the life out of me. I wish it had come to any one of you but me. If I tell it, it will mean murder, for sure. If I don't, it may bring the end of us all. God help me, but I am near out of my wits over it." McMurdo looked at the man earnestly. He was trembling in every limb. He poured some whiskey into a glass and handed it to him. "That's the physic for the likes of you," said he. "Now let me hear it." Morris drank, and his white face took a tinge of color. "I can tell it to you all in one sentence," said he. "There is a detective on our trail." McMurdo stared at him in astonishment. "Why, man, you're crazy," he said. "Isn't the place full of police and detectives? And what harm did they ever do us?" "No, it's no man of the district. As you say, we know them, and there is little that they can do. But you've heard of the Pinkertons. I've read of some folk of that name. Well, you could take it from me, you've no show when they're on your trail. It's not a take-it-or-miss-it government concern. It's a dead-earnest business proposition that's out for results and keeps out till by hook or crook it gets them. If a Pinkerton man is deep in this business, we are all destroyed. We must kill him, McMurdo said. Ah, it's the first thought that came to you. So it will be up at the lodge. Didn't I say to you that it would end in murder? Yeah, what's murder? Isn't it common enough in these parts? It is indeed, but it's not for me to point out the man that is to be murdered. I'd never rest easy again, and yet it's our own necks that may be at stake. In God's name, what shall I do? He rocked to and fro in his agony of indecision. But his words had moved McMurdo deeply. It was easy to see that he shared the other's opinion as to the danger, and the need for meeting it. He gripped Morris's shoulder and took him in his earnestness. "See here, man," he cried, and he almost screeched the words in his excitement. "You won't gain anything by sitting keening like an old wife at a wake. Let's have the facts. Who is the fellow? Where is he? How did you hear of him? Why did you come to me?" "I came to you, for you are the one man that would advise me. I told you that I had a store in the East before I came here. I left good friends behind me, and one of them is in the telegraph service. Here's a letter that I had from him yesterday. It's this part from the top of the page. You can read it for yourself." This is what McMurdo read. "How are the Scowrers getting on in your parts? We read plenty of them in the papers. Between you and me, I expect to hear news from you before long. 5 big corporations and the 2 railroads have taken the thing up in dead earnest. They mean it, and you could bet they'll get there. They are right deep down into it. Pinkerton has taken hold under their orders, and his best man, Bertie Edwards, is operating. The thing has got to be stopped right now. Now read the postscript. Of course, what I give you is what I learned in business, so it goes no further. It's a queer cipher that you handle by the yard every day and can get no meaning from." McMurdo sat in silence for some time, with the letter in his listless hands. The mist had lifted for a moment, and there was the abyss before him. "Does anyone else know of this?" he asked. "I have told no one else. But this man, your friend, has he any other person that he would be likely to write to?" "Well, I dare say he knows one or two more."
"Of the lodge?"
"It's likely enough. I was asking because it is likely that he may have given some description of this fellow Bertie Edwards. Then we could get on his trail." "Well, it's possible, but I should not think he knew him. He is just telling me the news that came to him by way of business. How would he know this Pinkerton man?" McMurdo gave a violent start. "By gar!" he cried. "I've got him. What a fool I was not to know it. Lord, but we're in luck. We'll fix him before he can do any harm. See here, Morris, will you leave this thing in my hands?" "Sure, if you will only take it off mine." "I'll do that. You can stand right back and let me run it. Even your name need not be mentioned. I'll take it all on myself, as if it were to me that this letter has come. Will that content you?" "It's just what I would ask." "Then leave it at that and keep your head shut. Now I'll get down to the lodge, and we'll soon make old man Pinkerton sorry for himself." "You wouldn't kill this man?" "The less you know, friend Morris, the easier your conscience will be, and the better you will sleep. Ask no questions, and let these things settle themselves. I have hold of it now." Morris shook his head sadly as he left. "I feel that his blood is on my hands." "Self-protection is no murder anyhow," said McMurdo, smiling grimly. "It's him or us. I guess this man would destroy us all if we left him long in the valley. Why, Brother Morris, we'll have to elect you bodymaster yet, for you've surely saved the lodge." And yet it was clear from his actions that he thought more seriously of this new intrusion than his words would show. It may have been his guilty conscience. It may have been the reputation of the Pinkerton organization. It may have been the knowledge that great, rich corporations had set themselves the task of clearing out the Scowrers. But, whatever his reason, his actions were those of a man who was preparing for the worst. Every paper which would incriminate him was destroyed before he left the house. After that he gave a long sigh of satisfaction, for it seemed to him that he was safe. And yet the danger must still have pressed somewhat upon him, for on his way to the lodge he stopped at old man Shafter's. The house was forbidden him, but when he tapped at the window, Eddie came out to him. The dancing Irish deviltry had gone from her lover's eyes. She read his danger on his earnest face. "Something has happened," she cried. "Oh, Jack, you are in danger." "It's not very bad, my sweetheart, and yet it may be wise that we make a move before it is worse."
"Make a move?"
"I promised you once that I would go some day. I think the time is coming. I had news tonight, bad news, and I see trouble coming."
"The police?"
"Well, a Pinkerton. But sure, you wouldn't know what that is, Akushla, nor what it may mean to the likes of me. I'm too deep in this thing, and I may have to get out of it quick. You said you would come with me when I went."
"Oh, Jack, it would be the saving of you."
"I'm an honest man in some things, Eddie. I wouldn't hurt a hair of your bonny head for all the world can give, nor ever pull you down one inch from the golden throne above the clouds where I always see you. Would you trust me?" She put her hand in his without a word. "Well, then, listen to what I say, and do as I order you, for indeed it's the only way for us. Things are going to happen in this valley. I can feel it in my bones. There may be many of us that will have to look out for ourselves. I'm one, anyhow. If I go, by day or night, it's you that must come with me."
"I'd come after you, Jack."
"No, no, you shall come with me. If this valley is closed to me, and I can never come back, how can I leave you behind? And me, perhaps, in hiding from the police with never a chance of a message. It's with me you must come. I know a good woman in the place I've come from, and it's there I'd leave you until we can get married. Will you come?"
"Yes, Jack, I will come."
"God bless you for your trust in me. It's a fiend out of hell that I should be if I abused it. Now mark you, Eddie, it will be just a word to you, and when it reaches you, you will drop everything and come right down to the waiting room at the depot and stay there until I come for you."
"Day or night, I'll come at the word, Jack."
Somewhat eased in mind, now that his own preparations for escape had been begun, McMurdo went on to the lodge. It had already assembled, and only by complicated signs and countersigns could he pass through the outer guard and inner guard who close-tiled it. A buzz of pleasure and welcome greeted him as he entered. The long room was crowded, and through the haze of tobacco smoke he saw the tangled black mane of the bodymaster, the cruel, unfriendly features of Baldwin, the vulture face of Haraway, the secretary, and a dozen more who were among the leaders of the lodge. He rejoiced that they should all be there to take counsel over his news.
"Indeed, it's glad we are to see you, brother," cried the chairman. "There's business here that wants a Solomon in judgment to set it right."
"It's Lander and Egan," explained his neighbor as he took his seat. "They both claim the head money given by the lodge for the shooting of Old Man Crab over at Stylestown. And who's to say which fired the bullet?" McMurdo rose in his place and raised his hand. The expression of his face froze the attention of the audience. There was a dead hush of expectation. "Eminent bodymaster," he said in a solemn voice, "I claim urgency."
"Brother McMurdo claims urgency," said McGinty. "It's a claim that by the rules of this lodge takes precedence. Now, brother, we attend you."
McMurdo took a letter from his pocket.
"Eminent bodymaster and brethren," he said, "I am the bearer of ill news this day, but it is better that it should be known and discussed than that a blow should fall upon us without warning which would destroy us all. I have information that the most powerful and richest organizations in this state have bound themselves together for our destruction, and that at this very moment there is a Pinkerton detective, one Birdie Edwards, at work in the valley collecting the evidence which may put a rope around the necks of many of us, and send every man in this room into a felon's cell. That is the situation for the discussion of which I have made a claim of urgency."
There was a dead silence in the room. It was broken by the chairman.
"What is your evidence for this, Brother McMurdo?" he asked.
"It is in this letter which has come into my hands," said McMurdo. He read the passage aloud. "It is a matter of honor with me that I can give no further particulars about the letter, nor put it into your hands. But I assure you that there is nothing else in it which can affect the interests of the lodge. I put the case before you as it has reached me."
"Let me say, Mr. Chairman," said one of the older brethren, "that I have heard of Birdie Edwards, and that he has the name of being the best man in the Pinkerton service."
"Does anyone know him by sight?" asked McGinty.
"Yes," said McMurdo, "I do."
There was a murmur of astonishment through the hall.
"I believe we hold him in the hollow of our hands," with an exulting smile upon his face. "If we act quickly and wisely, we can cut this thing short. If I have your confidence and your help, it is little that we have to fear."
"What have we to fear, anyhow? What can he know of our affairs?"
"You might say so if all were as staunch as you, counselor. but this man has all the millions of the capitalist at his back. Do you think there is no weaker brother among all our lodges that could not be bought? He will get at our secrets. Maybe he's got them already. There's only one sure cure.
That he never leaves the valley, said Baldwin.
McMurdo nodded.
Good for you, Brother Baldwin, he said. You and I have had our differences, but you have said the true word tonight.
Where is he, then? Where shall we know him?
Eminent Bodymaster, said McMurdo earnestly, I would put it to you that this is too vital a thing for us to discuss in open lodge. God forbid that I should throw a doubt on anyone here. But if so much as a word of gossip got to the ears of this man, there would be an end of any chance of our getting him. I would ask the lodge to choose a trusty committee. Mr. Chairman, yourself, if I might suggest it, and Brother Baldwin here, and five more. Then I can talk freely of what I know and of what I advise should be done. The proposition was at once adopted, and the committee chosen. Besides the chairman and Baldwin, there were the vulture-faced secretary, Haraway, Tiger Cormac, the brutal young assassin, Carter the treasurer, and the brothers Willoughby, fearless and desperate men who would stick at nothing. The usual revelry of the lodge was short and subdued, for there was a cloud upon the men's spirits, and many there for the first time began to see the cloud of avenging law drifting up in that serene sky under which they had dwelt so long. The horrors they had dealt out to others had been so much a part of their settled lives that the thought of retribution had become a remote one, and so seemed the more startling now that he came so closely upon them. They broke up early and left their leaders to their council.
"Now, McMurdo," said McGinty, when they were alone. The seven men sat frozen in their seats.
"I said just now that I knew Bertie Edwards," McMurdo explained. "I need not tell you that he is not here under that name. He's a brave man, but not a crazy one. He passes under the name of Steve Wilson, and he is lodging at Hobson's Patch."
"And how do you know this?"
"Because I fell in to talk with him. I thought little of it at the time, nor would have given it a second thought but for this letter. But now I'm sure it's the man. I met him on the cars when I went down the line on Wednesday. A hard case, if ever there was one. He said he was a reporter. I believed it for the moment. Wanted to know all he could about the scourers and what he called the outrages for a New York paper. Asked me every kind of question so as to get something. You bet I was giving nothing away. I'd pay for it and pay well," said he, "if I could get some stuff that would suit my editor. I said what I thought would please him best, and he handed me a $20 bill for my information. 'There's 10 times that for you,' he said, 'if you could find me all that I want.'
Well, what did you tell him?"
"Any stuff I could make up. How do you know he wasn't a newspaper man?"
"I'll tell you. He got out at Hobson's Patch, and so did I. I chanced into the telegraph bureau, and he was leaving it."
"See here," said the operator after he'd gone out. "I guess we should charge double rates for this."
"I guess you should," said I. "He had filled the form with stuff that might have been Chinese, for all we could make of it."
"He fires a sheet of this off every day," said the clerk.
"Yes," said I, "it's special news for his paper, and he's scared that the others should tap it." That was what the operator thought, and what I thought at the time. But I think differently now.
"By gar, I believe you're right," said McGinty. "But what do you allow that we should do about it?"
"Why not go right down now and fix him?" someone suggested.
"Aye, the sooner the better."
"I'd start this next minute if I knew where we could find him," said McMurdo. "He's in Hobson's Patch, but I don't know the house. I've got a plan, though, if you'll only take my advice."
"Well, what is it?"
"I'll go to the patch tomorrow morning. I'll find him through the operator. He can locate him, I guess. Well, then I'll tell him that I'm a freeman myself. I'll offer him all the secrets of the lodge for a price. You bet he'll tumble to it. I'll tell him the papers are at my house, and that it's as much as my life would be worth to let him come while folk were about. He'll see that that's horse sense. Let him come at 10 o'clock at night, and he shall see everything. That will fetch him sure."
"Well, you can plan the rest for yourselves. Widow McNamara's is a lonely house. She's as true as steel and as deaf as a post. There's only Scanlon and me in the house. If I get his promise, and I'll let you know if I do, I'd have the whole 7 of you come to me by 9 o'clock. We'll get him in. If ever he gets out alive, well, he could talk of Bertie Edwards' luck for the rest of his days. There's going to be a vacancy at Pinkerton's, or I'm mistaken. Leave it at that, McMurdo. At 9 tomorrow, we'll be with you. You get the door shut behind him, and you can leave the rest to us."
We'll return with Chapter 7, The Trapping of Birdie Edwards, right after these sponsor messages.
Hi, everyone. I know you've been hearing me talk about how much I enjoy BritBox. It's the streaming home of the best British TV, with exclusive mysteries, crime dramas, documentaries, and more. I especially enjoy mysteries like Agatha Christie's Poirot and Father Brown. I just enjoyed his story, The Thief, His Wife, and the Canoe. Great story. My daughter has always been a huge Cary Grant fan, and BritBox has a new original called Archie, which stars Jason Isaacs as Archie Leach, the man who became Cary Grant. This is the first time that his story has been told in collaboration with Grant's daughter Jennifer Grant and his ex-wife Diane Cannon. Story and cast all from BritBox, and it's top-notch entertainment, and only on BritBox. Sign up for BritBox today to stream Archie and other fan favorites from any device. I have a special limited-time offer for my U.S. and Canadian fans. Get 50% off your first month when you sign up for a monthly plan, but only if you go to BritBox.com and use my promo code 1001STORIES at checkout. That's 1001STORIES at checkout. Don't wait. Get 50% off your first month. Use promo code 1001STORIES at BritBox.com. You'll be glad you did.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
And now Chapter 7, The Trapping of Birdie Edwards. As McMurdo had said, the house in which he lived was a lonely one and very well suited for such a crime as they had planned. It was on the extreme fringe of the town and stood well back from the road. In any other case, the conspirators would have simply called out their man, as they had many a time before, and emptied their pistols into his body. But in this instance it was very necessary to find out how much he knew, how he knew it, and what had been passed on to his employers. It was possible that they were already too late, and that the work had been done. If that was indeed so, they could at least have their revenge upon the man who had done it. But they were hopeful that nothing of great importance had yet come to the detective's knowledge, as otherwise, they argued, he would not have troubled to write down and forward such trivial information as McMurdo claimed to have given him. However, all this they would learn from his own lips. Once in their power, they would find a way to make him speak. It was not the first time that they had handled an unwilling witness. McMurdo went to Hobson's Patch as agreed. The police seemed to take particular interest in him that morning, and Captain Marvin, he who had claimed the old acquaintance with him at Chicago, actually addressed him as he waited at the station. McMurdo turned away and refused to speak with him. He was back from his mission in the afternoon and saw McGinty at the Union House. "He's coming," he said. "Good," said McGinty. The giant was in his shirt sleeves, with chains and seals gleaming athwart his ample waistcoat and a diamond twinkling through the fringe of his bristling beard. Drink and politics had made the boss a very rich as well as a very powerful man. The more terrible, therefore, seemed that glimpse of the prison or the gallows which had risen before him the night before. "Do you reckon he knows much?" he asked anxiously. McMurdo shook his head gloomily. "He's been here some time, 6 weeks at the least. I guess he didn't come into these parts to look at the prospect. If he's been working among us all that time with the railroad money at his back, I should expect that he has got results, and that he has passed them on." "There's not a weak man in the lodge," cried McGinty. "True as steel, every man of them. And yet, by the Lord, there is that skunk Morris. What about him? If any man gives us away, it would be he. I have a mind to send a couple of the boys round before evening to give him a beating up and see what they can get from him." "Well, there'd be no harm in that," McMurdo answered. "I won't deny that I have a liking for Morris and would be sorry to see him come to harm. He has spoken to me once or twice over lodge matters, and though he may not see them the same as you or I, he never seemed the sort that squeals. But still, it is not for me to stand between him and you."
"I'll fix the old devil," said McGinty with an oath. "I've had my eye on him this year past."
"Well, you know best about that," McMurdo answered. "But whatever you do must be tomorrow, for we must lie low until the Pinkerton affair is settled up. We can't afford to set the police buzzing, today of all days."
"That's true," said McGinty, "and we'll learn from Bertie Edwards himself where he got his news, if we have to cut his heart out first. Does he seem to scent a trap?"
McMurdo laughed. "I guess I took him on his weak point," he said. "If he could get on the good trail of the Scourers, he's ready to follow it into hell. I took his money." McMurdo grinned as he produced a wad of dollar notes, "and as much more when he's seen all my papers."
"What papers?"
"Well, there are no papers, but I filled him up about constitutions and books of rules and forms of membership. He expects to get right down to the end of everything before he leaves."
"Faith, he's right there," said McGinty grimly. "Didn't he ask you why you didn't bring him the papers?"
"As if I would carry such things, and me a suspected man, and Captain Marvin after speaking to me this very day at the depot."
"Aye, I heard of that," said McGinty. "I guess the heavy end of this business is coming on to you. We could put him down an old shaft when we've done with him, but however we work it, we can't get past the man living at Hobson's Patch, and you being there today."
McMurdo shrugged his shoulders. "If we handle it right, they can never prove the killing," said he. "No one can see him come to the house after dark, and I'll lay to it that no one will see him go. Now see here, counselor, I'll show you my plan, and I'll ask you to fit the others into it. You will all come in good time."
"Very well."
"He comes at 10. He is to tap 3 times, and me to open the door for him. Then I'll get behind him and shut it. He's our man, then."
"That's all easy and plain."
"Yes, but the next step wants considering. He's a hard proposition. He's heavily armed. I've fooled him proper, and yet he is likely to be on his guard. Suppose I show him right into a room with 7 men in it where he expected to find me alone. There's going to be shooting, and somebody's going to be hurt."
"That's so.
And the noise is going to bring every damn copper in the township on top of it."
"I guess you're right.
This is how I should work it. You will all be in the big room, same as you saw when you had a chat with me. I'll open the door for him, show him into the parlor beside the door, and leave him there while I get the papers. That will give me the chance of telling you how things are shaping. Then I will go back to him with some faked papers. As he is reading them, I will jump for him and get my grip on his pistol arm. You'll hear me call, and in you will rush. The quicker the better, for he is as strong a man as I, and I may have more than I can manage. But I allow that I can hold him till you come."
"It's a good plan," said McGinty. "The lodge will owe you a debt for this. I guess when I move out of the chair I can put the name to the man that's coming after me."
"Sure, counselor. I'm a little more than a recruit," said McMurdo, but his face showed what he thought of the great man's compliment. When he had returned home, he made his own preparations for the grim evening in front of him. First he cleaned, oiled, and loaded his Smith & Wesson revolver. Then he surveyed the room in which the detective was to be trapped. It was a large apartment, with a long deal table in the center, and the big stove at one side. At each of the other sides were windows. There were no shutters on these, only light curtains which drew across. McMurdo examined these attentively. No doubt it must have struck him that the apartment was very exposed for so secret a meeting. Yet its distance from the road made it of less consequence. Finally, he discussed the matter with his fellow lodger. Scanlon, though a Scourer, was an inoffensive little man who was too weak to stand against the opinion of his comrades, but was secretly horrified by the deeds of blood at which he had sometimes been forced to assist. McMurdo told him shortly what was intended.
"And if I were you, Mike Scanlon, I'd take a night off and keep clear of it. There will be bloody work here before morning."
"Well, indeed, then, Mac," Scanlon answered. "It's not the will but the nerve that is wanting in me. When I saw Manager Dunn go down at the colliery yonder, it was just more than I could stand. I'm not made for it, same as you or McGinty. If the lodge will think none the worse of me, I'll do just as you advise and leave you to yourselves for the evening." The men came in good time as arranged. They were outwardly respectable citizens, well-clad and cleanly, but a judge of faces would have read little hope for Bertie Edwards in those hard mouths and remorseless eyes. There was not a man in the room whose hands had not been reddened a dozen times before. They were as hardened to human murder as a butcher to sheep. Foremost, of course, both in appearance and in guilt,
was the formidable boss. Haraway, the secretary, was a lean, bitter man with a long, scraggy neck and nervous, jerky limbs, a man of incorruptible fidelity where the finances of the order were concerned, and with no notion of justice or honesty to anyone beyond. The treasurer, Carter, was a middle-aged man with an impassive, rather sulky expression and a yellow parchment skin. He was a capable organizer, and the actual details of nearly every outrage had sprung from his plotting brain. The two Willoughbys were men of action, tall, lithe young fellows with determined faces, while their companion, Tiger Cormac, a heavy, dark youth, was feared even by his own comrades for the ferocity of his disposition. These were the men who assembled that night under the roof of McMurdo for the killing of the Pinkerton detective. Their host had placed whiskey upon the table, and they had hastened to prime themselves for the work before them. Baldwin and Cormac were already half-drunk, and the liquor had brought out all their ferocity. Cormac placed his hands on the stove for an instant. It had been lighted, for the nights were still cold. "That will do," said he, with an oath. "Aye," said Baldwin, catching his meaning. "If he is strapped to that, we'll have the truth out of him." "Oh, we'll have the truth out of him, never fear," said McMurdo. He had nerves of steel, this man, for though the whole weight of the affair was on him, his manner was as cool and unconcerned as ever. The others marked it and applauded. "You are the one to handle him," said the boss approvingly. "Not a warning will he get till your hand is on his throat. It's a pity there are no shutters to your windows." McMurdo went from one to the other and drew the curtains tighter. "Sure, no one can spy upon us now. It's close upon the hour." "Maybe he won't come. Maybe he'll get a sniff of danger," said the secretary. "He'll come, never fear," McMurdo answered. "He is as eager to come as you can be to see him." "Hark to that." They all sat like wax figures, some with their glasses arrested halfway to their lips. Three loud knocks had sounded at the door. "Hush!" McMurdo raised his hand in caution. An exulting glance went around the circle, and hands were laid upon their weapons. "Not a sound, for your lives," McMurdo whispered, as he went from the room, closing the door carefully behind him. With strained ears, the murderers waited. They counted the steps of their comrade down the passage. Then they heard him open the outer door. There were a few words as of greeting. Then they were aware of a strange step inside and of an unfamiliar voice. An instant later came the slam of the door and the turning of the key in the lock. Their prey was safe within the trap. Tiger Cormac laughed horribly, and Boss McGinty clapped a great hand across his mouth. "Quiet, you fool!" he whispered. "You'll be the undoing of us all." There was a matter of conversation from the next room. It seemed interminable. Then the door opened, and McMurdo appeared, his finger upon his lip. He came to the end of the table and looked round at them. A subtle change had come over him. His manner was as of one who has great work to do. His face had set into granite firmness. His eyes shone with a fierce excitement behind his spectacles. He had become a visible leader of men. They stared at him with eager interest, but he said nothing. Still with the same singular gaze, he looked from man to man. "Well?" cried Boss McGinty at last. "Is he here? Is Bertie Edwards here?" "Yes," McMurdo answered slowly. "Bertie Edwards is here. I am Bertie Edwards." There were 10 seconds after that brief speech during which the room might have been empty, so profound was the silence. The hissing of a kettle upon the stove rose sharp and strident to the ear. 7 white faces, all turned upward to this man who dominated them, were set motionless with utter terror. Then, with a sudden shivering of glass, a bristle of glistening rifle barrels broke through each window, while the curtains were torn from their hangings. At the sight, Boss McGinty gave the roar of a wounded bear and plunged for the half-open door. A leveled revolver met him there with the stern blue eyes of Captain Marvin of the mine police gleaming behind the sights. The boss recoiled and fell back into his chair. "You're safer there, counselor," said the man whom they had known as McMurdo. "And you, Baldwin, if you don't take your hand off your pistol, you'll cheat the hangman yet. Pull it out, or by the Lord that made me. There, that'll do. There are 40 armed men round this house, and you can figure it out for yourself what chance you have. Take their pistols, Marvin." There was no possible resistance under the menace of those rifles. The men were disarmed. Sulky, sheepish, and amazed, they still sat around the table. "I'd like to say a word to you before we separate," said the man who had trapped them. "I guess we may not meet again until you see me on the stand in the courthouse. I'll give you something to think over between now and then. You know me now for what I am. At last I can put my cards on the table. I am Birdie Edwards of Pinkerton's. I was chosen to break up your gang. I had a hard and dangerous game to play. Not a soul, not one soul, not my nearest and dearest, knew that I was playing it. Only Captain Marvin here and my employers knew that. But it's over tonight, thank God. And I am the winner. The seven pale, rigid faces looked up at him. There was unappeasable hatred in their eyes. He read the relentless threat. Maybe you think that the game is not over yet. Well, I'll take my chance of that. Anyhow, some of you will take no further hand, and there are 60 more besides yourselves that will see a jail this night. I'll tell you this, that when I was put upon this job, I never believed there was such a society as yours. I thought it was paper talk, and that I would prove it so. They told me that it was to do with the freemen, so I went to Chicago and was made one. Then I was surer than ever that it was just paper talk, for I found no harm in the society, but a deal of good. Still, I had to carry out my job, and I came to the coal valleys. When I reached this place, I learned that I was wrong and that it wasn't a dime novel after all. So I stayed to look after it. I never killed a man in Chicago. I never minted a dollar in my life. Those I gave you were as good as any others, but I never spent money better. But I knew the way into your good wishes, and so I pretended to you that the law was after me, and it worked just as I thought. So I joined your infernal lodge, and I took my share in your counsels. Maybe they will say that I was as bad as you. They can say what they like, so long as I get you. But what is the truth? The night I joined, you beat up old man Stanger. I could not warn him, for there was no time. But I held your hand, Baldwin, when you would have killed him. If ever I have suggested things so as to keep my place among you, they were things which I knew I could prevent. I could not save Dunn and Menzies, for I did not know enough. But I will see that their murderers are hanged. I gave Chester Wilcox warning, so that when I blew his house in, he and his folk were in hiding. There was many a crime that I could not stop. But if you look back and think how often your man came home the other road, or was down in town when you went for him, or stayed indoors when you thought he would come out, you'll remember my work.
You blasted traitor, hissed McGinty through his closed teeth.
Aye, John McGinty, you may call me that if it eases your smart. You and your like have been the enemy of God and man in these parts. It took a man to get between you and the poor devils of men and women that you held under your grip. There was just one way of doing it, and I did it. You call me a traitor, but I guess there's many a thousand will call me a deliverer that went down into hell to save them. I've had 3 months of it. I wouldn't have 3 such months again if they let me loosen the treasury at Washington for it. I had to stay till I had it all, every man and every secret right here in this hand. I'd have waited a little longer if it hadn't come to my knowledge that my secret was coming out. A letter had come into the town that would have set you wise to it all. Then I had to act, and act quickly. I've nothing more to say to you, except that when my time comes, I'll die the easier when I think of the work I've done in this valley. Now, Marvin, I'll keep you no more. Take them in and get it over. There is little more to tell. Scanlan had been given a sealed note to be left at the address of Miss Eddie Shafter, a mission which he had accepted with a wink and a knowing smile. In the early hours of the morning, a beautiful woman and a much muffled man boarded a special train which had been sent by the railroad company and made a swift, unbroken journey out of the land of danger. It was the last time that ever either Eddie or her lover set foot in the Valley of Fear. 10 days later, they were married in Chicago, with old Jacob Shafter as witness of the wedding. The trial of the Scourers was held far from the place where their adherents might have terrified the guardians of the law. In vain they struggled. In vain the money of the lodge, money squeezed by blackmail out of the whole countryside, was spent like water in the attempt to save them. That cold, clear, unimpassioned statement from one who knew every detail of their lives, their organization, and their crimes was unshaken by all the wiles of their defenders. At last, after so many years, they were broken and scattered. The cloud was lifted forever from the valley. McGinty met his fate upon the scaffold, cringing and whining when the last hour came. 8 of his chief followers shared his fate. 50-odd had various degrees of imprisonment. The work of Birdie Edwards was complete. And yet, as he had guessed, the game was not over yet. There was another hand to be played, and yet another and another. Ted Baldwin, for one, had escaped the scaffold. So had the Willoughbys, and so had several others of the fiercest spirits of the gang. For 10 years they were out of the world, and then came a day when they were free once more, a day which Bertie Edwards, who knew his men, was very sure would be an end of his life of peace. They had sworn an oath on all that they thought holy to have his blood as a vengeance for their comrades, and well they strove to keep their vow. From Chicago he was chased, after 2 attempts so near success that it was sure that the third would get him. From Chicago he went under a changed name to California, and it was there that the light went out for it. And it was there that the light went for a time out of his life when Eddie Edwards died. Once again he was nearly killed, and once again under the name of Douglas he worked in a lonely canyon, where with an English partner named Barker he amassed a fortune. At last there came a warning to him that the bloodhounds were on his track once more, and he cleared, only just in time, for England. And thence came the John Douglas, who for a second time married a worthy mate, and lived for 5 years as a Sussex County gentleman, a life which ended with the strange happenings of which we have heard. We'll return with the epilogue right after this sponsor message.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
And now, epilogue. The police trial had passed, in which the case of John Douglas was referred to a higher court. So had the quarter sessions, in which he was acquitted as having acted in self-defense.
"Get him out of England at any cost," wrote Holmes to the wife. "There are forces here which may be more dangerous than those he has escaped. There is no safety for your husband in England."
2 months had gone by, and the case had to some extent passed from our minds. Then one morning there came an enigmatic note slipped into our letterbox.
"Dear me, Mr. Holmes, dear me," said this singular epistle. There was neither superscription nor signature.
I laughed at the quaint message, but Holmes showed unwonted seriousness.
"Deviltry, Watson," he remarked,
and sat long with a clouded brow. "Late last night, Mrs. Hudson, our landlady, brought up a message that a gentleman wished to see Mr. Holmes, and that the matter was of utmost importance. Close at the heels of his messenger came Cecil Barker, our friend of the moated manor house. His face was drawn and haggard.
"I've had bad news, terrible news, Mr. Holmes," said he. "I feared as much," said Holmes.
"You have not had a cable, have you?"
"I have had a note from someone who has."
"It's poor Douglas. They tell me his name is Edwards, but he will always be Jack Douglas of Benito Canyon to me. I told you that they started together for South Africa in the Palmyra 3 weeks ago."
"Exactly."
"The ship reached Cape Town last night. I received this cable from Mrs. Douglas this morning. Jack has been lost overboard in a gale off St. Helena. No one knows how the accident occurred. Ivy Douglas."
"Ha! It came like that, did it?"
said Holmes, thoughtfully.
"Well, I've no doubt it was well stage-managed."
"You mean you think there was no accident?"
"None in the world."
"He was murdered?"
"Yes, surely."
"So I think also. These infernal scourers, this cursed vindictive nest of criminals."
"No, no, my good sir," said Holmes. "There's a master hand here. It's no case of sawed-off shotguns and clumsy six-shooters. You can tell an old master by the sweep of his brush. I can tell a Moriarty when I see one. This crime is from London, not from America."
"But for what motive?"
"Because it is done by a man who cannot afford to fail, one whose whole unique position depends upon the fact that all he does must succeed. A great brain and a huge organization have been turned to the extinction of one man. It is crushing the nut with the trip hammer, an absurd extravagance of energy. But the nut is very effectually crushed all the same."
"How came this man to have anything to do with it?"
"I can only say that the first word that ever came to us of the business was from one of his lieutenants. These Americans were well advised. Having an English job to do, they took into partnership, as any foreign criminal could do, this great consultant in crime. From that moment their man was doomed. At first he would content himself by using his machinery in order to find their victim. Then he would indicate how the matter might be treated. Finally, when he read in the reports of the failure of this agent, he would step in himself with a master touch. You heard me warn this man of Burlstone Manor House that the coming danger was greater than the past. I was right."
Barker beat his head with his clenched fist in his impotent anger. Do not tell me that we have to sit down under this. Do you say that no one can ever get level with this King Devil?
No, I don't say that,
said Holmes, and his eyes seemed to be looking far into the future.
I don't say that he can't be beat, but you must give me time. You must give me time.
We all sat in silence for some minutes while those fateful eyes still strained to pierce the veil. We hope you enjoyed this story, Parts 1 and 2, The Valley of Fear, by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the last of four Holmes novels that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle wrote. We've had some wonderful reviews for 1001 Sherlock Holmes Stories and the Best of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and we'd like to share a few with you. First one, 5 stars, favorite Holmes podcast. This is my favorite Holmes podcast I've found. Even now when I read Holmes stories, your voices for Watson and Sherlock are the ones I hear in my head. Nice work. That one from D.W. Wooden, Apple Podcast, U.S. And this one, excellent, 5 stars. I just found you and your 1001 podcast. I'm in heaven. Your narration is spot on and holds my attention. I signed up for all the other 1001 podcasts. Thank you so much for all you do. That one from B.B. Sunny, Apple Podcast, U.S. And this one, amazing stories, 5 stars. I'm a photographer and I love to listen while I'm editing my photos. Also while cleaning my house. I love the adventures that Dr. Watson and Sherlock take us in. Thank you for reading the stories with so much enthusiasm and creativity. It keeps me entertained for hours. And now that I've listened to all of them, I have to wait every Sunday for a new one. I'm actually going back and listening to some of the older ones all over again. My top podcast for sure. Thank you. Suji, Apple Podcast, U.S. And this one. Keep up the good work, 5 stars. I'm so thankful I found this podcast last month. I've been listening almost every day since while working. Keep up the good work. Down from Yayu, Apple Podcast, France. And this one, fantastic, 5 stars. Absolutely love the 1001 Stories podcast, and the Sherlock Holmes stories are by far my favorite. You have the perfect voice for reading these stories, John. Thank you very much. That one from Jess in Oz, Apple Podcast, Australia. Thank you all so very much for taking the time to send us these reviews. There are a number of great reasons for giving a review, and a number of great reasons why we appreciate them so much. I'll give you a few. 1, so we can get to know you and why you listen. 2, because we want to know what you like most about the podcast. 3, how and why you've enjoyed our stories. And so we can put a pin in the map for wherever you're listening from. All I can tell you is that I am grateful and humbled by your reviews. And that's what keeps me going. Thank you so much for being a part of our listening audience. Our next story will be a Sherlock Holmes story. I'm going to keep it a surprise until next week, Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Until then, everyone, stay safe, and we'll be back soon.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.